Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
Welcome back. Taxation is theft, and I'm still getting the kinks worked out of this new system. So I think we're live. I do see some people coming in and some comments coming up. I've got with me today Dustin Evans, who is a libertarian candidate, and we're just going to talk. He's got some interesting stories. We were just talking about some interesting things about, you know, whether or not you should wear a big yellow hat while you're campaigning, or a camouflage hat. How's it going? Welcome.
It's going good, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So I guess first, let's talk about the position you're running for, and give us an idea about that. What are you doing? What are you trying to do? Who are you up against? Why are you doing this?
So I'm running for House of Delegates in Southern Virginia for the 16th District. I'm running against Les Adams. He's a Republican. He's been in there for three terms. He was challenged his first term, but the last two terms he's run unopposed. The main reason I'm running is because our area has become really stagnant. I really don't feel like he's done anything to help the area out. I'm running on agriculture reform and reforming healthcare. That's the main thing I'm trying to tackle, is trying to help our area out.
Awesome. So we were talking about attire right before we got this started, There's the philosophy that when you're talking to farmers, like what do they say? Don't show up dressed like a banker, or, you know, they don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah. So I really am a country boy. My whole family's been in the country for most of my life. When you go out and talk to people in the country, the average candidate wants to wear, like, unfortunately, what I'm wearing tonight, they want to wear a suit and tie. And when you talk to the farmers, that's not what they want to see at all. They want to see someone that's from the area. Because in normal day-to-day life, I'm wearing my campaign shirt, jeans, and a camo hat. But then the flip side, when you start going on podcasts or doing interviews, you kind of want to wear a suit, because if you're just wearing like a mossy oak hat and you're talking about agriculture reform, they just kind of think you're a country bumpkin. So it's a balancing act on that one.
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting too, because we see you know, these politicians who we know are nothing but career politicians, and they try to do that every once in a while. I think, like, who was it they made fun of? Was it Beto or Biden, who was out like in jeans and t-shirt or a plaid shirt or something? I don't know. It's funny because they do that. They try to do the opposite. And, you know, hey, look, I'm one of you. What's that meme? Hello, fellow teenagers. I'm one of you.
Yeah. Yeah, with the Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
It kind of sucks. I really hate wearing a suit. I've never worn a suit most of my life. I know they say you should dress for the job you want, but I really feel suits are kind of outdated. I mean, it's a classic look. My wife definitely appreciates it when I do wear a suit, but they're really not comfortable. Like, I've never met anyone that really enjoys wearing a necktie. Even when I wear a suit, I try to not wear a necktie.
Yeah, as much as everybody sees me in this wonderful hat and this amazing suit and tie that I have, I absolutely hate it too, especially down here in Mexico, where it's like anywhere between 90 and 100 degrees with the AC on.
It really is absolutely ridiculous. Like we talked before, I'm a really big history nerd, and that was what I got my bachelor's in. And I had to read this. We had to do this article one semester. It was really interesting, but it was how AC transformed the South. And it was talking about how AC was so influential to Houston, Texas. And I can't imagine living in Houston, Texas before the invention of AC, because you see all the pictures from the 1800s and the early 1900s. Everyone's wearing a three-piece suit with long underwear. And you've been in Houston. You know what the weather's like in the summer. And everyone's just walking around like, oh, yeah, this is totally normal. Like,
Yeah, what's because you also have to consider, like, you know, they didn't have bottled water filtered the way it is now. And you would have to think, without AC, you got to be chugging down like 5 gallons a day.
Yeah, dude, they didn't have bottled water, and people usually bathed once a week. I can only imagine how bad that city really smelled back in the day.
Oh, man. Yeah, that is absolutely crazy to think about. I'm sweating just thinking about it. Yeah,
my wife, she's from Florida. Like, her whole family's from Florida. A lot of them, like, half of them live in Savannah, Georgia, and the other half live down by the Keys, like in Sarasota, Florida. And they've been there forever. I always think about that every time they tell me about their grandpa growing up in Sarasota back in, like, the 40s and 50s. And I'm like, he probably wore a suit. I can only imagine how nasty that felt, like, on a regular basis.
Right. Kids these days don't know how well they have it. And then you picture AOC, who's complaining, you know, oh, the rent's too high, we're living in poverty, and it's like, well, you got AC, right? It's
exactly,
it's all relative. Man,
every generation has a new struggle.
Yeah, no, and it's certainly interesting. I always talk about that a lot, because it's not, you know, it's not like, a lot of people associate poverty with just not having anything. Which of course is all relative, but I like to say it's struggling just to get by with, you know, whether it's what you have or not. And of course, that's all government's fault. That's all the taxes that you have to keep up with. That's, you know, all this other stuff. You got to work harder just to keep what you have, and all that stuff that comes along with all these social programs that they force you to participate in. And, you know, of course, they sell it like, yeah, well, your life is so much better because of these. And if it weren't for these, your life would be so much worse. But they're not paying for your AC.
Yeah.
It's yeah. So let's talk more about like, so why are you running exactly? What do you plan to accomplish? And what's your opponent trying to accomplish that's not, I guess, the opposite of what you want, it sounds like?
Right. So my area is a big agriculture area. I live in outside of Danville, Virginia, and that name probably means nothing to a lot of your listeners and viewers. Danville, once upon a time, was the biggest tobacco area in the entire world. And if you smoked Marlboros or Camels or pretty much any cigarette, the tobacco came from my region. So my area has always been a steady agricultural hub. And, you know, tobacco is on its way out. And that's not a bad thing whatsoever, because I smoked for years. I've quit a couple of years back. And I definitely don't encourage anyone else to smoke, so I have no fault in that. But it really doesn't hurt the farmers around here, and they've been trying to find a way forward. What I've been running on is reforming agriculture completely. Last year, with the farm bill, they allowed for hemp farming. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like that is a good way for the farmers to transition. But there's still a lot of regulations on hemp. And like I said, my area is a big agriculture hub. The two things we grow, for a lot of people that are not familiar with agriculture, is you have your main crop, and then you have what's called a rotation crop. You rotate your crops out so it doesn't completely deplete your soil. That was something we learned from the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. Excuse me. The crop we rotate with is soybeans, which, if anyone's familiar with Trump's tariffs right now, soybeans is actually one of the most tariffed crops. So the farmers are being hit on both ends, so they're having to completely rely on subsidies. So what I'm focusing on is repealing a lot of the regulations and allowing for more farmers to get into hemp farming. I'm also focusing on repealing a lot of regulations in dairy and a lot of other styles of farming. One of the big things that I really want to focus on, which as a libertarian, it's going to come off as absolutely crazy, is called the land use tax. And it's something we have in Virginia. And that's why I say it's crazy, because I've never met another libertarian before that's pushing for taxes.
Right. Yeah. I'm like, are you trying to pick a fight here?
So what the land use tax does is, if you own a farm, it's a statewide initiative, but they give it to localities to see if they want to use it. The localities that need it most do not use it. In Northern Virginia, they use it, but Northern Virginia is around D.C. There's not a lot of agriculture there. So what the land use tax does is say, if you have a working farm, instead of paying property tax on your farm, you pay what's called a land use tax, and you only pay a certain percentage of what you sell. So this tax is actually lowering the amount of taxes you pay into the system, and it encourages agriculture. I want to move that from a locality base to a complete statewide base, because I think it would, A, we're going to be paying less taxes. B, it's going to encourage more agriculture in the regions that desperately depend on agriculture.
So you say it's going to lower taxes, and so it sounds like you mean it's, you're going to cut one tax and replace it with this in order for that to work. Is that right?
Yes and no. You're definitely getting the taxes. They're still there. But it's not that you're cutting one tax and you're replacing it with another tax. It's you're putting in the land tax, and you're going to see other business, like, they're paying more into the system because you're going to start seeing them buy seed from local people. You're starting to see them sell locally. So the taxes are still going to be there, but it's just what, like, it's going to lower what the average landowner is going to have to pay.
So how does, I don't see how that lowers it. If you're, let's say I own a farm and there's right. There's a new land tax, which is on, which I pay when I sell, let's say I'm growing carrots. I sell my carrots, and then I pay the tax on the sale of the carrots at that point, right?
Right.
So I'm still, it's a tax. It's almost an income tax or a sales tax at that point of sale. So if that's going to be on top of everything else, why wouldn't I say, hey, I'm going to grow more carrots because I don't have to pay taxes on this at all. If you're going to tax that more, why, you know, I guess
would be your incentive to switch over.
Well, I guess there's nothing you could switch to, because anything you switch to is still going to have that same tax, right? Like,
right.
So I guess I can't say it would make me not want to grow as much, but it still seems like it's an extra tax. So how does that calculate to what you're saying, where I'm going to pay less?
Okay, so normally, if you own a farm, you pay a property tax, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, depending on your locality, the property tax or real estate tax or what have you can be exponentially high. Once you switch the land use tax, you don't have to pay that real estate or property tax.
So this is to replace the property tax then?
Yeah, and actually significantly lowers it.
Okay,
and
that makes sense.
And the reason I think it's a good idea is because it's going to encourage agriculture. And what I actually want to do is right now, like I said, it varies varies locality to locality. I would like to do, on average, it's, you have to have at least 30 acres with 5 years history of farming. I would like to switch it to, if you have at least 10 acres, you can get in from the get-go. But if you have between 10 to 30, you get that window where you can get right in. But if you have more than 30, then you have to have a five-year farm. The reason I want to do this is it's going to encourage more small-scale farming, and it's going to encourage more people to go into co-ops, which at first, you know, I've talked to a lot of farmers, and they're like, well, I don't really know a lot about a co-op farming, but in my area, we actually have a really big dairy. It's in Georgia. They distribute in Georgia. They distribute in Texas. They distribute in North Carolina, South Carolina. It's called Homestead Creamery. And it's based in Virginia, in Southside Virginia, and they're actually a co-op, and all the farmers band together, and they make some of the best milk you've ever had and some of the best ice cream you've ever had. And they've been extremely successful by banding together that way. But it allows people to be their own boss, to start a farm, and it encourages you, like, you're paying less in taxes, so it's going to encourage more agriculture in the area.
Right. I hear that, and it sounds like, it's not necessarily that bad. Some people are going to be paying, and I see that it sounds like you're lowering the barrier of entry to switch over and take advantage of that,
right,
of that lower tax. So, you know, that sounds good, but it's still, it is still kind of difficult as being the complete anti-tax guy, to say, let's go for it. But
I completely understand,
but it's
my area. We're like, no one knows who the Libertarian Party is here.
Right.
Like, there's a few of us, but as I've been going out and talking to people, like, I've been confused with the Socialist Party by saying libertarian. They're like, are you the Socialist Party? I'm like, no, quite the opposite, actually. So,
right, you mean like a liberal?
Libertarian... Yeah, that's exactly what they think. They're a libertarian, that means liberal party, right? So to get these libertarian ideas in, it's very difficult because this area has never had it. So by targeting not complete ending of taxation, but lowering taxes and providing less regulations on business owners and farm owners, people get that, and they're willing to buy into that.
So who's in favor? Because I would think if you talk to a farmer and you would say, hey, we just want to get rid of all your taxes, I would think every single one of them would be like, hell yeah, let's do it.
Right.
So, but then you probably have the people who might be in the cities because property tax usually either goes to the county or to the state. There are other people who are probably in bigger cities that say like, no, we need property taxes because my police and all this other stuff, which in the rural areas, you don't really have police the same way you do in a city.
Right.
So what's kind of, let's talk about your district. Is your district all farmland or does it include some cities? Do you have that?
So, I'd say it's about 80% farmland, 20% city. But like I said, all the cities around DC where you could get that argument like, oh, well, like we need taxes. They're already opted into this. They're like those are the areas that are already opted in. It's actually beside my district and all the way to the Tennessee, West Virginia border. That's not opted in. That like it's actually outside of my district, but that is an area that would benefit that area tremendously because it is an agricultural hub like that. Like once you get west of my district, it's all agricultural. That's all it is. And it would benefit those people tremendously. So that's why I'm fighting for that, because it would encourage agriculture in the south side of my state. That's one of the ones I'm kind of looking outside of my district, just trying to help the state out as far as agriculture goes.
Right. So now I'm also thinking, you know, there's the argument, let's say you have this big plot of land, right?
Right.
And you're not doing anything with it, and you're getting hit with a property tax. So you can see, like, obviously where the incentive is, like, hey, if you plant some stuff and, you know, do a little bit of farming or whatever, you're going to save money on your taxes. So it's kind of a net increase of your income. At the same time, if you start farming on your land and you're going to sell that product, that's a net increase anyway. So it's kind of interesting to think when government says we're going to tax you less in order to get you farming, why is that more of an incentive than just saying, hey, if you start farming, you're going to make money? Why do you need to tax the people who aren't doing things with their land in order to get them to do something with their land versus just saying, you know, if you're not doing anything with your land, you're not making any money. Why don't you do something with it and make some money?
Long story short, it's pretty much a blue state. It's really difficult to sell ending taxes on people. Like my dream would be for Virginia to be a tax-free state like Texas, Delaware, and Florida is.
Oh, they've got taxes. I mean, it's not a...
Yeah, no, like income
tax. Income tax, right.
No income taxes, and their other taxes are
relatively still got
lower
like,
compared to my state is.
Yeah, they've still got land taxes, and I think they have some, you know, I don't know what it's called, but it's a similar thing. Like if you have, you know, they have rules like where if you have at least 20 head of cattle, then you get the tax discount or, you know.
Right, no, they still have some taxes, but by and large, as opposed to my state, it's relatively lower. Like this right. is the bad part of being. You know, majority of Virginia is a suburb of Washington, D.C., so we get a lot of the fallout from that. The reason I push for that is there's no way we can completely say taxation is theft. We're getting rid of taxes completely. The best I could do is chip away at it bit by bit, and that's my goal, is to slowly erode the system and to do whatever I can to help the people out in my district in Southern Virginia, because my area by and large has been pretty much in poverty for the last 50 years, especially the last 20 years. It's gotten really bad compared to the northern part of the state. In the early 1900s, when agriculture was a really big mainstay in most states' economy. We were doing really well. As it's transitioned, it's been floundering. Now, I'm very much aware that agriculture is not what's going to completely save the area. It's not where we're the agriculture hub. We're making a lot of money. But I do believe it's a step in the right direction to try and build the agriculture back up and then trying to bring industries in here, especially with hemp. Hemp is such a good textile that if we can create hemp farms, it would encourage more areas more industries to come to the area to start making mills, to start making cloth and other clothing materials.
Right.
Especially since it's in the backyard, it decreases transportation costs.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about that for a little bit. Because you said they're starting to grow that, but it's still pretty regulated. What kind of regulations are we talking about?
Okay, so you register with the state, you have to pay a fee, and you have to if you want to buy, sell, or own hemp, the raw hemp, you have to register with the state. Now, the big thing right now, the reason it's so costly is you have two options for growing. You can either buy seeds or you can buy clones. Now, the bad thing about hemp is because it has such a correlation with marijuana, it's so tightly monitored. So if your hemp plant gets above 0.3 THC, they'll come out randomly inspected. If they're like, this plant's 0.04, you have a week to burn that plant. Well, if you buy clones are extremely expensive. You're looking at like close to $100 a plant. If you try and plant quite a few, you know, that could be a very costly, if they're coming out testing them and they're burning them. Seeds are pretty cheap, but it's a shot in the dark. You don't know what the THC count could be on it. I want to remove some of the regulations right now that you don't have to register with the state and go through the process. If you're a farmer and you want to transition to it, you can plant up to 10 plants. You don't have to register with the state. You can't sell it, but you can at least experiment to see if that's something you'd be interested in going through.
Interesting. Yeah, no, those all sound like great ideas. I wonder, what was I going to ask? So we were talking about crop rotation before, and right. I've heard that the hemp plant actually helps to replenish the soil instead of all the other crops that kind of take, I guess, minerals and everything else out.
Yeah. So most crops suck nutrients out of the soil. Like I said, that's why you had the Dust Bowl, was they were just planting the exact same crop, and it was literally just sucking all the nutrients out of the ground. Hemp is almost nutrient neutral. It really doesn't take that many nutrients from the soil. And the great thing about it is right now a lot of people are trying to go green. And as libertarians, I've met a lot of libertarians that also want to go green, but they don't like the idea of like the new Green Deal. They don't want government coercion. They want to figure out a way that people individually can go green. Hemp is a great way for that because 1 acre of hemp produces more oxygen than a 20-acre forest.
Oh, wow.
So and it could also make plastics. It can make concrete. It can make clothing. It can make food. It can make a lot of things. And like I said, it's takes very little nutrients, and it produces so much oxygen. This is a really good green alternative, and it's a lot of most libertarians are behind hemp. I actually don't think I've met any libertarian that's anti-hemp.
Right.
But especially now, where the Democrats want to push the new Green Deal, this is a really good alternative to it. Is pushing more green agriculture. Yeah, it's a greener deal. Let's push more green agriculture.
Awesome. So, and I've been following all this hempcrete stuff. There is a company I just saw out of Canada actually that built a plane out of hemp, and everything's made out of hemp except I guess the engine and the engine runs on hemp oil or hemp fuel. It's really amazing. And you're a history buff. So, it used to be, I think, World War II, the feds were actually subsidizing hemp because they needed it to produce fabric, rope for the Navy, all kinds of stuff for the war. Is that right?
Yeah, it was actually World War I. They were pushing it for that. If you owned a farm back prior to 1920s, where it started to become illegal, prior to that, though, if you owned a farm, you were required by the government to grow hemp.
Oh, wow.
Because we had a rope shortage and it made such good rope. So if you own a farm, you grew hemp. So a lot of people now are like so blind to it, they don't realize it's such an integral part of American history. George Washington grew hemp. Thomas Jefferson also grew hemp. And it really started to see in the 1920s is when it kind of got demonized. A lot of libertarians know this story anyway. But William Randolph Hearst owned the majority of the newspapers in America at the time. He also had a lot of stock and paper mills and timber mills. And we know that hemp was poised to replace paper for a cheaper source of income, cheaper source of paper. But he was already so heavily invested. He's one of the richest men of the time. So he lobbied Congress heavily to outlaw hemp so it wouldn't compete with his businesses. Wow.
That bastard.
Money talks. Yeah, money talks, man. There's a reason they named Citizen Kane after him.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. I was actually... So I grew up in California, and there's the Hearst Castle up on the yeah. coast, and we would always drive past it. And I never actually went there until I was, I don't know, it was pretty recently, like maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And I went, and they turned it into like, there's a theater you can go inside and like watch the whole story. And it's, you know, it's got all the stuff about how he made his fortune in silver and it's, yeah, it's just really, really interesting story. But of course, you know, they spin it so he looks like the good guy, but you kind of look around and he's got like, he owned this massive piece of the coast, and he had, you know, he's importing animals from all over the world and importing art and pieces of, you know, history and everything. And it's almost like you can kind of look at that and just see like, well, this is kind of arrogant to do that, like to take these things from around the world that, it kind of goes into like, I guess, the Europeans who go down to Egypt and start tearing apart the pyramids and all that history just to put it in museums and all this other stuff.
Yeah, it's, Hearst was an interesting guy in the sense that, he was, when you think of, I always joke, I'm like, what would a cartoon bad guy, you know, bad guy villain, you know, if you're a billionaire,
right,
like the evil version of Scrooge McDuck, and that was William Randolph Hearst. Like, have you heard the story about the sharks in his house?
No.
So he had a bunch of aquariums, but he really liked sharks, and he's like, I want to build a tank for sharks in my house. And he actually built like a moat in this one room where it was just like a straight moat and had like a bridge to go over, and I think it was in his like library. And he just wanted sharks to swim through it all day long. And, I think he tried to put great whites in there at first, but that's why we actually don't have great whites in captivity, is because there's their nerve endings and how they detect electrical pulses, how they find prey. Like, all the water pumps that was going through was just literally driving them insane because could detect the electricity everywhere.
So he was the one to figure that out?
No, I think he, like, it took him a while after that because he kept being like, why are all the sharks dying and, like, riding around? But then also they really didn't understand salt water and iron pipes at the time. So, like, it just constantly had to keep, like, fixing it because it kept being eroded.
Wow.
It's just, yeah, it's the roaring 20s. He was the richest man on the planet. Like, you start reading stories about him and it's just, like, the level of excess is just completely ridiculous.
I'm just thinking of like Ace Ventura, where you have that
yeah,
crazy
yeah,
evil
exactly.
rich guy with his great white in like this little tank.
Yeah, that was what William Randolph Hearst was trying to do in the 1920s.
Oh, it's, man.
That's why I love history. Like, sorry about that. I've been obsessed with history my whole life. And the further you go down the rabbit hole, like the story of Lincoln, That doesn't interest me anymore because I've heard like about Lincoln's presidency so many times. It's the esoteric like cliff notes of history that I find really interesting, like William Randolph Hearst, and there's quite a few other. Like, right. Especially if you start looking into like why marijuana is illegal and start going back to the congressional hearings of them trying to make it illegal. Most people don't go that deep into it, but it's really fascinating and it's really mind blowing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is crazy because you can look at like Facebook or Twitter and the amount of news that comes out in one day. And you have to imagine, like, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, not everything was being documented or consumed, or like maybe it was, and just, you know, as we're born today, we, you know, we have all this new information coming out every day. We can't read 50 years worth of history to that detail. And it's like, yeah, we really are getting kind of the Cliff's Notes of everything. One interesting one, like, so, cause I've always been attacking the income tax. I talked to an interesting guy who was kind of giving me, you know, they come from this group where, you know, the income tax there, it's the tax honesty movement, right? The income tax doesn't apply to normal Americans. It really applies to government employees, you know, that sort of thing. It's a privileged excise tax, and they go through like the history of how the tax was formed and created, and they go through the tax code to explain it and prove it. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, so I'm finally getting my head wrapped around this and I understand it now, but how did we get from a point where, if this is the case, one day we have no income tax and today everybody is paying it, even if they're not obligated to? And right. And so this one guy finally explained to me, it was World War II. And what happened was that, so the income tax was supposed to be on income from the government, right? Because that's, you know, the government's jurisdiction to order people and tell them what to do is limited to people that work for them, obviously, right? So right. The government could tell their agencies, hey, when you pay this person, withhold some of their money. It's illegal for them to tell a private business to do that, because there's no due process. There's no, you know, there's nothing else. You're telling them to withhold a tax before the tax is even calculated or evaluated. It's completely illegal. But what happened was, when World War II came along, and they said, you know, the government started subsidizing everything, right? Like, we need to get everything going. We need every factory full speed. That was government money going to all these corporations and factories and everything. And because of that, it was like, okay, you want these subsidies? Here's the thing. You sign up for the contract. Everybody kind of becomes government employees, and you agree to withhold. And now everybody's paying income tax. But everybody didn't care, because they were like, hey, new jobs, more money, all this other crap. And then the war was over, and everybody was just kind of used to that's the way things were. So now that the subsidies weren't going in anymore, they had the infrastructure in place, and everybody was used to just paying this income tax. And so now it goes on, and now corporations that are employing people, their HR departments and their accounting departments are just like, yeah, we fill out this form and we do this, but it's all it's all not necessary at this point. It's just conditioned. So it's interesting to see that, you know, you take that event and put it in there, and that's how it happens.
No, it totally is. And I consider myself a history nerd, as I was saying. And being a history nerd, being a libertarian, it kind of clashes sometimes, because as a history nerd, I really like FDR and the things he did. But as a libertarian, you realize all the rot he did to the system. It's one of those kind of boondoggles. It was World War II. It was such a special time, like, in world history, nothing like that had been done before. So I don't agree with a lot of things he did, but I really don't know what a lot of the solution was to the issues we had at the time.
Right. But yeah. And I guess especially based on the information you have too. I mean, it's, you know, we, like, even today, we have the Federal Reserve, and, you know, at no other point in history has there been a central bank that's been that big or had that much control over an economy, like, basically the world's economy. So, you know, it's really difficult to be able to say, oh, well, we know if we flip this switch and turn this knob, we know exactly what's going to happen, because we've never been in this exact position before. So yeah, that is interesting.
I think a lot of it goes back to, you know, he did what he felt like he had to do at the time to fix the situation. But at the same time, I reflect on Ron Paul, who said, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government measure.
Right. Right. So there's a question coming in from Eric. He's asking if you can elaborate on the firefighter bill in Virginia. You know anything about that?
Yeah. So they've been trying to push this bill through the last couple of years in Virginia. They've made some headway. There's still a lot of fights to be done. Virginia, the majority of Virginia, we have volunteer firefighters. Like when you're in Texas, did you have volunteer firefighters or were they all paid?
Outside of the city, they had volunteer departments. Well, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm actually a big fan of volunteer firefighters because to me, that's the libertarian dream. It's these people are dedicating right. their time and their energy to help people out. The big issue, and I've worked with a lot of firefighters, is now they have a 70% higher chance of getting cancer than the average person. And the reason for that is because most homes and most things made in the world now are all made from synthetics and plastics. So these are all cancerous smoke when that they they're burn. Inhaling. Yeah. Getting on their skin, everything. So the last couple of years, they tried to push through a cancer bill for the firefighters. And it goes for both the paid and for the volunteer. And it's if they can track cancer, and it's only certain types of cancer. It's not every type of cancer. So it's like esophageal, it's 10 of them. I can't go through it right now. But if they contract it, that the state will pay for it. The state will cover their cancer treatment. And that's something I've actually been behind because, especially for the volunteer firefighters, if we want to preserve the volunteer effort, we need to at least protect them a little bit. Because if we're not going to protect them from cancer and we know it's only going to get worse, we're going to see people fewer and fewer people volunteering for the fire department.
Right.
So that's something I've been pushing, but right now they're trying to push it through for brain, testicular, and colon. That's the big one that's they're pushing for right now. And that's something I want to see expanded upon because I actually have a good friend who was in the VFD, volunteer fire department, and he actually got testicular cancer. And a lot of people think that the cancers that firefighters normally get would be respiratory, but it's actually their firefighter suit. Since it is fire retardant and they're sweating in it, there's chemicals in it that prevent them from catching on fire. And all of that, when you sweat, all of that's just going down on your body. So mm-hmm. we see them have much higher cases of testicular cancer. So that's something that I'm actually trying to push to go through right now. And that's something that if I get elected, I want to co-sponsor a bill to see that put in action to protect and preserve volunteer firefighters.
Right. Wow, it's interesting. Yeah, and there's a few different ways to look at that because there's also, they're trying to do something similar with the 9/11 first responders. There's and of course, this is something that has to be paid for one way or another. I'd prefer a voluntary means myself, but yeah, absolutely. This is something that these are people who actually are risking their lives, unlike the traffic cops or the drug cops, drug enforcement cops. They're actually risking their lives to save other people's lives. And that should absolutely be rewarded. But I think there's another side to that too. And, I know so many people who have had cancer. My mom passed recently from it was some type of a blood cancer. Is the best way they could describe it. And when I look at, what I know about the healthcare industry, it's like people are, we hear all these like, oh yeah, donate for cancer, run for cancer. They have the marathons and all this other stuff. And most of that money doesn't ever really go to research. It's like,
right.
But then you look at like, why not? And why don't we have better research? And it's the government that's basically saying that they're making it impossible for people to do that kind of research. And when you find something, they're making it impossible for you to get that to market.
Also, they're paying salaries for a lot of people too. That's why whenever I donate to charities, I always make sure to look at the charities and how much actually right. goes to the cause, because a lot of them, for every dollar you donate, only a penny will go for that because they're paying the CEOs and all the board members.
Right. So it's all administrative. It's like they take the money, they reinvest it back in advertising and they grow the thing. And it's insane. And I think some of the biggest offenders are like the red and the pink ribbon.
Yeah. Yeah, the pink ribbon is a really bad one from what I've looked into it. But the reason I really pushed this through and really I've gone out and spoke to several fire departments about it, and I really want to fight for them and make sure it's taken care of, is the three fire departments that surround my house, that if something happened, that they would respond to me. All three of them are volunteer. And, you know, if the cancer rates keep going up, you know, if there's only so much that people would be willing to help out if they know that, hey, I'm 100% going to get cancer, but no one's going to cover me, you're going to see that completely fall off. And then it's going to have to get to the point where the state's going to have to pay for paid firefighters. And then that cost is going to go way through the roof.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Let's talk about, because I know, you know, so many people live in the city and they can't comprehend the idea of volunteer anything. Let me ask this, like, in your area, do you have police? Do you have sheriff?
So we have sheriff's deputies in my area. And it's funny you actually said that about people living in the city, they can't comprehend volunteer.
Right.
Because one of my best friends, he's actually an aide on my campaign. He's from Finland. We went to college together. He was an exchange student. And, you know, now he's kind of on the libertarian bandwagon. Like, obviously, it helped me out. When I first met him, he was anti-gun, you know, but, like, he was used to the Finnish big government. And I remember the first time I talked to him, he's like, I don't understand why Americans have so many guns. And I was like, well, I've got like 20, maybe 25. Blew his mind. And he was just like, yeah, that many guns? I'm like, yeah, you want to go shooting? So I took up shooting, and then, like, I've slowly been chipping away at him. But I remember we were sitting in class. We actually did a whole class just studying Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. And they were in that book, Alexis de Tocqueville talks a lot about the volunteer efforts in American democracy. That's what helps it survive so much as compared to French democracy at the time. And my buddy, his name is Temu, he had actually never heard of a volunteer fire department. And like I said, I've got a lot of friends that do volunteer fire departments. So I actually took him out to one and he did a tour. And it blew his mind because you see these people that they eat, sleep, and breathe fire department. They're just as dedicated. I feel they're actually more dedicated than paid fire department people, because these are people that are not getting paid. And if they're not working, they're not spending time with their spouse or family, they're at that fire department. They're eating there, they're sleeping there, and they're constantly training. They don't get paid to do this. They do this solely out of the joy of trying to help people and save lives.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and they do a lot of medical help also, right?
Yeah, they're all EMS certified. Every one of them is EMS certified. It's amazing. I've got friends that are 60, 65 that have been doing it their whole life. I would trust them more, like a lot of them, I would trust them more than most paid EMSs because I know they're dedicated to it. And then I know a lot of kids that are 18 years old just coming into it, and they live at that station. You know, they have like a part-time job. The second they get off, they're at that station. They don't have a wife. They don't have a girlfriend. They get off from their job, they go there, and they just hang out with the old firemen, just trying to learn everything they can because they become, it's a way of life. You know, especially you look at New York, you look at the New York firefighters, it's like a brotherhood, a unified brotherhood.
Right.
You see the same thing with these volunteer firefighters. That's my brother. I want to hang out with them. I want to cook with them. I want to learn everything I can from them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really awesome. And I mean, like, even, you know, further down that road, because there are people who do want to help the community with stuff like that. I was just reading, I want to say it was Ben Franklin, who basically, wherever he was, he built libraries. He built, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably know better than it, libraries, schools, you know, all these other things that are usually taxpayer funded. He kind of did on his own. And I would imagine, like, see, this is the thing, right? We're all like trapped in this mindset that in order to survive, we have to get at least a 40-hour job every week, which consumes all of our time. We're tired after that, and we can't comprehend, using the rest of our time to do things like building our own houses and everything. But you look at so many societies where like people just come together out of having that time and not having that full-time job and being able to say, hey, we should build a school. And people will get together and say, okay, let's get the lumber together. Let's build it, or let's build a library, or, you know, it's like all of our spare time has been taken away from us. And I blame taxes, of course, so that we're like constantly laboring and we're not allowed because of time, we're not allowed to do these other things. And it's like, that's kind of, I think that's one of the reasons that it's so difficult to comprehend volunteer anything, because it's like, who's got the time for that? We've all got to, you know, pay our rent and eat.
No, exactly. And it's funny because to harken back to what I was just saying about my friend that's from Finland, I thought it was hilarious the first time we were hanging out and we saw a homeless individual come up to us and they asked, could I get $2? You know, I gave it to him immediately. My friend's like, but, you know, kind of getting the cold shoulder. And I was like, what's that about? He's like, why are they asking for money in Finland? You know, there's welfare, there's programs like this. And he's like, go to the government office. I don't have to help you out whatsoever. And because government is so instilled in their brains, you know, if someone's down there, look, I have a problem giving them $1, $2, what have you.
Right.
But the Finns are like, go get a job. You know, like go to the welfare office. The welfare office will help you. And they're so disconnected from humanity on that aspect. And that's why he was kind of mind blown from the volunteer fire department is the more government builds up, the more you see a disconnect from your local community, because why do I have to help you? Why do I have to do these charities? The government should be providing them. But once you have charities and people volunteering, there is more of a sense of community. People are more invested into the local atmosphere. But with taxes decrease all this, but I'd say it's more of government, constant government buildup that says, you don't need to do that. We'll do it for you. You don't worry about your neighbor anymore because they can go.
And we see a lot of that in, you know, in bigger cities too, like where it's just people just walking by when you've got like herds of, like you go to New York, there's herds and herds of people just walking by anyone begging for change. And it's like, nobody wants to help. But I think there's also like, you know, worse than that, like we see like YouTube videos where like somebody falls on the train tracks and instead of anybody getting up to help, they all pull out their phones and they just record it.
Yeah. So, with New York, where you said about the homeless, I've gone up to New York several times. I love it. But you know, anyone that's been up there knows it has a massive homeless population. And everyone that's from New York just, you know, like horse blinders just walks past them. And me being from the South, where in the South everyone just talks to each other, it was really different. Like last time I went up there, I still smoked. And every time a homeless person would see me with a cigarette, they'd ask, hey, can I get one? And I had no problem. I'd give them a cigarette and I'd sit and talk to them while they smoked and be like, hey, where are you from? Like, how did this happen? And you get really weird, like almost like suspicious looks, like, why are you talking to me like this? But that's humanity. And it's so much of it's removed. Like, we put these safety nets out to help people that fall. But a lot of times the safety nets end up creating a barrier between people.
You know, that's you're reminding me of when I first moved to Texas. To San Antonio from Los Angeles. And I remember like, you know, within the first month or so, I was walking around like a Home Depot and every aisle I went to, the Home Depot employee would come up to me, hey, do you need any help finding anything? And it was like, just really like genuine, like, yeah, can I help you? Versus like in Los Angeles, it was like, when they see you coming down the aisle, they all run. So like, yeah. Oh shit, a customer. I don't want to deal with that. Yeah, that's really interesting, but that's like a cultural, but I mean, you know, San Antonio's, it's growing, but it's still relatively a small city. So I think that's, that is really interesting.
I'll tell you one more story about this. Cause my uncle thought this was like the most preposterous thing ever. Like I'm going up there. My uncle spends a lot of time in New York and it was the last day of my last trip. And there's this, if you ever go to New York, there's this restaurant called Hot Key in Chinatown. It's like some of the best Chinese food you'll ever have. And I couldn't finish my dish. And my plan was I was going to take it, eat it on my way to the airport. And I was on the subway and this guy was asking for change. And I was like, hey man, I don't have change, but I've got this full plate of Hot Key. Would you like that? And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I give it to him, and I pause and say, hey, this has a lot of peanuts in it. Do you have a peanut allergy? And he looks at me, he's like, no. I was like, okay, I just want to make sure you don't have a peanut allergy before I give it to you. And, like, my uncle and everyone else on the train is like, what do you care if he has a peanut allergy? I'm like, dude, I'm trying to give him food to live off of. I don't want to kill the guy. Like, right. That completely defeats the point of me trying to help him out.
Yeah.
But they just thought that was so preposterous that I would actually care to ask if he had a peanut allergy before I gave him the food.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting, too. You see a lot of people who are just kind of – they kind of give out of guilt and not out of wanting to help somebody. And I think that's, you know – that's kind of the nature of how that's been commercialized, right? Because that's how, like, all the commercial charities kind of try to guilt you into, like, paying money to their, you know, their organizations that most of the money goes to the CEOs.
Well, like, me and my wife first met, you know, whenever you go to the grocery store line, they're like, would you like to donate such and such for charity? And I would always tell them no. And my wife's like, why do you do that? They're giving it to charity. I'm like, no, because half times I don't give to charities unless I look to see where they're giving. So I know, like we said, right, how much they're giving. But B, I don't like giving it through grocery stores because then they get to take that and use that as a tax write-off. It's they're just using that to help their bottom line out. It's not some, oh, we're helping people out. It's kind of almost like a nefarious motive behind it. They're giving, right, but they're giving so they can get that charitable write-off at the end of the year.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? Like, because government's always trying to say, like, oh, yeah, we're morally perfect, and we know all of the right things that people should be doing to be good to each other and not break laws and not hurt people. And, you know, that's the government's position. But then you see what's legal, what's really legal and what's illegal. And it's like some of the most, you know, helpful things that you could do, like feeding the homeless, can be illegal. And then you have
like Kansas City, they're putting bleach on the food in Kansas City.
Yeah. And then you have these like state sanctioned charities that are basically just stealing all your money and not helping anybody, and that's perfectly okay. And they're using this for, like you said, for tax write-offs and all these other nefarious purposes, and that's okay. The government's like, yeah, that's okay. But it's, yeah, you really have to see that to understand that these politicians are not writing laws to help people. They're scamming us just as much as all these, you know, these big corporations that everybody hates.
So let me ask you a question, because, you know, I vape now, and I had this conversation with my wife earlier, especially because of Michigan banning the flavored cigarettes. I mean, sorry, the flavored vapes, and Andrew Cuomo, who I never like Andrew Cuomo anyway. Shout out to Larry Sharp on that one. He definitely should have won. But now New York, you know, Andrew Cuomo's threatening executive action to ban flavored vape juice. And I was asking my wife, because we always had this conversation, I'm like, do you really own yourself? Like, because the state's stepping in and telling you how to live your life. Can you really say that you own yourself because the state's telling you they know what's best for you?
Right. Yeah, I've actually got you can't see it, but like on my, you know, everyone covers their camera on their laptop. Right. Mine has a cutout from my business card that says, we are not, oh, here, I've got it on the back of my thing up here. We are not government property. It's too bright to see.
Yeah, I can't see it.
But yeah, we are not government property. I print that all over everything. Because yeah, you know, absolutely. If they're telling you what you can or can't put in your own body, then you are not your own property. But it's interesting to see a lot of these things like how they do this, right? Because what does, it's really interesting. Everybody thinks we're in a free country and that the government somehow took away those freedoms, and that we're not in a free country anymore. But when you look at a lot of that they're not even operating under the Constitution anymore. But when you look at how they do a lot of things, it's actually less about violating our rights, or overstepping their constitutional authority, and it's really more about defrauding us into consenting to their stuff. So you know, it's really difficult to say, but with something like the income tax, which nobody should be paying, but they have us believing we should be paying, or driver's licenses, which only apply to commercial transportation, but everyone believes it applies to everything. But then you have cannabis, where, okay, it's just a plant. I'm putting it in my own body. The government doesn't really have a constitutional authority for that, but they're still going to arrest you. It doesn't matter if you have a license or anything. You can't just say, oh, I know the law and you can't arrest me. You're going to jail if you're in possession of that. And so, right. So it's like there's a mix of that. And we have so many people who kind of support, they support this malicious behavior, whether it's fraud or not, whether the government has the constitutional authority or not. They don't care if they're in agreement with it. Well, I don't care if it violates the Constitution. I don't think people should be smoking pot, so send them to jail anyway, right? And
well, you look at if you go back and look at the original congressional transcripts from when it became illegal, it was 100% a racist act, and it's just continued on. So you talk to people now, it's like, why is it illegal? And they're like, well, because this. And so they're like, oh, because it's bad for you. It's like, well, it's not bad for you. I mean, it's not good for you. Anything you put in your lungs other than oxygen is not good for you. But there's no chance of overdose. There's right. No evidence of addiction rate to it. But it's still illegal. And you're like, so
and
how
even if it was,
illegal
it's not
originally?
As bad as alcohol.
Yeah, it's not as bad as alcohol. But you look back to why is it illegal, and it goes back to old Jim Crow laws, is they were just trying to find anything they could to possibly arrest the Mexicans and the African-American community at the time, and especially now where you have – think about it. You have you lose your voting rights if you have any felonies. That was just such a gateway for them to restrict minority right. voting back in the day.
Let's give everyone a felony.
Yeah. And it's just transcribed to today. And people, it's, you know, once a law has been on the books for so long, people just accept it as the norm.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's there's, you know, a question you can ask in regard to that. Like, okay, well, if it was legal right now, would you vote to make it illegal to kind of reframe it? Because, you know, some people will say, well, that's the law is the law, you know? But it's like, okay, but assume it's not the law. Would you vote for it to become the law? And I think even then people have a hard time accepting that hypothetical scenario, and they just go to, well, yeah, because it's already illegal. So I don't see why we wouldn't just make it illegal again if it were legal. Like it makes absolutely no sense.
Well, it's funny. Once things become legal for so long, people accept it, and vice versa. Once things are illegal for so long, people say, oh, it's reasons for that. Because there's a quote from, I think it was the head of the FDA in 1979. They said, if Tylenol was brought on the market today, we 100% would outlaw it. And this was back in 1979 because of all the dangers it could do to your kidneys, stomach, and liver. But look how widely accepted Tylenol is. You know, like most people don't think about Tylenol as a deadly drug, but it right. really does destroy your organs. Then you look at marijuana, which, I mean, it might destroy your lungs over time through tar, but by and large, it's not destroying any other organs. And we know the CBD that's in marijuana is 20 times stronger of an anti-inflammatory than Tylenol, aspirin, Midol, what have you. So why is it still illegal? It's because it's just been in people's minds for so long that they just have that taboo that it's morally wrong for it.
Right. And I think, you know, incremental change is because I was debating with someone last night who, you know, he had some crazy tax plan. And, you know, he had this plan and he was like, it's never been tried before. And he wants to implement this plan over the entire country. And I'm like, do you have any proof? He wanted to incentivize, you know, how a family is gonna work by giving them a subsidy. And I said, has this ever been tried before anywhere in the world? And he said, no. And I said, so, and now you want to force the entire country to have this program. How do you know it's going to work?
was it a universal basic income that he was
trying to push?
No,
it was he wanted to so broken families where the parents separate and they fight over custody of the child, to basically say if you move back in together, we'll give you a subsidy. Will it work?
That sounds like a horrible idea. Why would you push that? Like,
and my counter to that was, we do have kind of a program like that where if you get married to somebody, you get citizenship. And that system's been completely abused. Like, people pretend to get married. So why wouldn't people pretend to move in just so that they could get some free money from the government? Like, I think that's another, it's a system that would be abused. Now, granted, he has good intentions and he's trying to bring broken families together. Maybe they shouldn't be. Like that's the thing. Like, who are you to control people's lives? But the biggest objection to that is you have no proof of that exact plan working, and now you want to force that on the entire country. And so I'm thinking, you know, if you apply that same thing to cannabis, right? Because we can't say, I mean, I guess we can, because we could look at like Portugal, right? We could say like, oh yeah, well, they decriminalized all drugs and everything was fine. Okay, yeah, but Portugal's different. It's not the United States, and they don't have the problems and everything that we have, the racial and cultural differences between all these different people. So it's different. Okay, fine. But in the U.S., we did kind of incrementally try this, right? Like, we started with medicinal cannabis, so only some people would have access to it. And then we saw, okay, so it's not that big of a deal. And then and that was in one state only. And then other states started saying, well, it works, so let's try it here. And then after that, it was, you know, incremental. Let's try recreational. Let's try decriminalizing. Let's try turning it from a felony to a citation. And incremental, it's still in a favorable direction, and all of us wanted to go faster, but it's working because it's incremental, and people have less to object on it when you go incrementally than when you try to just go full on, we're gonna flip the whole thing upside down and you know, yeah, just trust me, it's gonna work. You know, that scares people.
I know you've lived in different countries. I've lived in several different countries throughout the years. As Americans, we like to look at different regions of the world and be like, well, it works there, why doesn't it work here? And one thing I've noticed throughout my years of traveling is America really is a completely different beast from any other country. And it goes down to our people, to our way of life. Because you look at Portugal, you look at the Netherlands and say, it works there, why won't it work here? And I think I always look back to like my buddy from Finland. He loves, like, even though now in America he's very libertarian, but he loves the Finnish healthcare system. He loves this universal healthcare. But he understands that it wouldn't work in America because when we first met, he was always asking, he's like, why does America have universal healthcare? Why don't you guys do it? It works great in Finland. Why won't it work great here? And my answer is always like, go to the DMV and tell me if that's who you want running your healthcare. And he actually had to go to the DMV like 2 weeks later. And I was like, yeah, man, American bureaucracy. I don't know why. We're just terrible at it. There's some countries that can kind of figure it out, but every country is different. Every country has this different set of problems, has a different type of populace. It's going to take a gradual change, like especially what you're saying about cannabis. It's going to take a gradual change because I don't think it's going to be like we flip the light switch like it was in Holland or Portugal. I think we're going to have a steady stream of challenges we're going to have to face throughout the years for it.
Right.
Because the way it's going now, as it's going state by state, I can tell you what, Wyoming and Idaho, maybe Kentucky, it's going to be the last holdouts unless it gets federally mandated.
Right. I don't know. Texas is, I kind of want to say Texas is going to be the last just because of what they are, but they've actually, you know, they've had a little bit of progress. So, we'll see.
Like Virginia, we've actually, a lot of people don't realize Virginia is actually a medicinal state, but I think right now you only have like 4 dispensaries you can go to.
Oh, wow.
And the whole closest state? One for me. Yeah. The closest one for me is like, I want to say a 4 or 4.5 hour drive.
Wow.
but it's only open to people that have like stage 4 cancer. And you know, when you go to the dispensaries under medicinal, the actual patient has to go there. So if you have stage 4 cancer, you're not going to be able to make a 4.5-hour each way trek to go to a dispensary. Right. You're going to be too bedridden for that. So that I would like to see. Obviously, I like to see that get pushed more, because I do feel as far as medicinal goes, it does help do a lot to help cancer patients. But Virginia, even though as blue as it is, it's, you know, it's a long way off from that one.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's like, yeah, it's great to say that it's a step in the right direction, but it's also, you know, some states just, maybe it's that bureaucracy. They're just so slow at doing it. Let's see, here I actually have a question for you. I just scrolled down and saw some of these, and of course I can't even tell what time this came in. In what ways can you make government in Virginia smaller than your incumbent hasn't?
Well, the big thing is, yeah, okay, sorry, I thought you froze for a second. You're just reading. So my incumbent actually voted to increase the state budget by 15%. So that's obviously going to grow Virginia's government size. And he voted to give Amazon $750 million in taxpayer subsidies. And the way my state is choosing to do the subsidies is different from how, remember when AOC was rallying against the subsidies they were going to bring into the Amazon plant in Queens, I believe it was? Mm-hmm. Where they were just getting tax breaks. In Virginia, we're going to subsidize $22,000 of every Amazon employee's salary. So,
wow.
And you look at how many people they're wanting to hire, and each person is getting $22,000 in subsidized funds. And we know that Amazon didn't pay federal taxes last year. So, like, we're just paying in. They're not getting anything out. This is how I'm going to start shrinking the government is, A, I'm not voting to raise taxes in Virginia like he did. B, I'm not voting to expand the state budget, because they expanded the budget so they can add on more employees. We need to start shrinking it. We need to streamline it and cut the fat and figure out how can we – like, my family was military. My wife's family is military. Now my dad is actually a civilian contractor. I've been around the government most of my life. I know the government overspends for a lot of things. There's a lot of bloat to that system. And we need to focus on getting rid of the bloat and how can we make the system work without having to have all these additional people. Because I know for a fact that a lot of them are additional people that we don't need, that don't need to be on hand. It's just because anytime you put money into a government organization, they're going to take it all day long. They're never going to tell you, oh, we're good. We don't need it anymore. They're going to constantly keep taking it, constantly keep hiring people. We need to streamline it, and we need to stop increasing the budget. If anything, we need to decrease the budget.
Right. Yeah, that's the – I mean, man. Somebody was they were writing an article about – I'm trying to think of what it was. It was a private sector job versus a public sector job. Pretty much the same job. Like, so I think it was like a – whether it was an engineer or, you know, something like that, an administrator. And basically, or maybe it was a postal worker, but basically the government employee was getting paid twice as much as what the private sector employee was getting for about the same job. And they got the public sector person basically said, you know, once they retire, they have a pension, which means they're going to continue to receive their salary afterwards. And they were trying to like vote against this budget cut because it would have cut their pension in half, which meant after they retired, they would only be receiving 50% of their salary, which was still the same salary that the private sector was working. But the way that they framed it was like, oh, yeah, their pension's going to be cut in half and they're only going to be making half as much money after they retire. And it's like, hey, what about the people who are actually working for real companies and actually producing something that benefits the economy? What's so special about the government employee that they get all these extra perks? And it's, you know, you really see the government, whether it's intentional or not, the way that they hire so many people and they pay them so well, builds that just that mentality of state worship, because it's like, you know, it's like that's the hand that feeds you. It becomes your God and your master and provider of everything.
So don't get me wrong, I don't knock anyone that takes a government job. People are trying to feed their families. It's a good paycheck. I totally understand why they want to take it. And I don't knock them, you know, if they, that was what they were told they were going to get, they worked there and for it, that's fine. But like I said, there's a lot of excess to it. There's a lot of jobs that are kind of unnecessary. Like, I grew up around military bases my whole life. Now, if you go to a military base, back in the day, it used to be in that I was an Air Force brat, so we called them security forces, Army guys, we called them MPs, military police. That would be at the gate checking your ID. Now, that department still exists, but they moved them back, and then they do a different job now, and they've hired additional security, public security to sit there and check IDs all day. And that's literally all they do. They sit and check IDs. And, you know, they're getting a fat government salary, getting benefits, all of that. And that, to me, I've always saw that as wasteful. It's like, you still have the people that was doing it. Why did you have to bring in additional people to sit and check IDs all day that are, they're going to make, you know, close to $30 an hour, or between $20 to $30 an hour, and then they're going to get a full retirement after 20 years. And most of these people are people that already retired from the military and going back and doing it, just, you know, they're getting their military retirement and then doing it on top of that. I just never understood why they didn't just continue to use the security forces or military police to do that. It always seemed like a waste of government funds to me.
Right. Absolutely. Man. All right. Well, I think we're at about time for the show, but so let's get some information on your website. If anybody wants to volunteer or donate or help out in any way, what can they do?
Okay, so we actually just launched our website today. It's Dustin Evans for delegate.com. If you would like to volunteer or donate, we have a message board on there. You can send us a message. We also have a link to our email address at the bottom of the website. That's DustinEvansForDelegate@gmail.com. Like I said, it's on the website. But if you go to our website, it can connect you to our Facebook, our Instagram, and our Twitter.
Awesome. All right. I guess with that, we will leave it here. And taxation is theft. All right. I'll see you around. We'll see you. Everybody go check out the website. Follow all the social media pages. Of course, follow mine as well. And we'll see you next week.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.